ARD.
Die Idee vom NDR, heute mit dem Produzenten und Showrunner Frank Dölger. Frank Dölger ist der Produzent von Serien, die viele von euch wahrscheinlich kennen, den HBO-Serien Game of Thrones, Rome und John Adams. Er ist sechsfacher Gewinner der Emmy Awards. Die Emmy Awards sind ja die wichtigsten TV-Preise in den USA. Und aktuell ist er verantwortlich für die Entwicklung und Produktion bei Intaglio Films. Die Firma hat unter anderem die Serien Der Schwarm produziert. Wie produziert man Game of Thrones? Wie arbeitet man mit Kreativen und SchauspielerInnen? Und wie war es, Gast in der legendären Disco Studio 54 zu sein? Denn auch da war Frank damals dabei. Darüber habe ich mit ihm gesprochen, auf Englisch. Und ich gebe euch das auch als Original, denn darin hört man einfach mehr Zwischentöne als in jeder Übersetzung. Vorab gibt es noch einen Programmtipp. Ich möchte euch 11KM, den Tagesschau-Podcast, ans Herz legen. Die Aufgabe dieses Podcasts, Geschichten zum Weitererzählen und Recherchen, die bewegen. Unser Team geht jeden Tag von Montag bis Freitag mit jeder Folge in die Tiefe und sie nehmen sich da Zeit für ein aktuelles Thema, entweder aus Politik, Wirtschaft, Kultur oder Sport. Die Geschichten sind immer handverlesen und es sind viele Recherchen dabei, spannend, investigativ und hochwertig. Ihr hört das jetzt in der ARD Audiothek, der Audio-App der ARD, unter ardaudiothek.de oder in den App-Stores eurer Smartphones. Hallo zusammen, ich bin Norbert Grundei und hier ist die Idee vom NDR. I'm talking today with producer and showrunner Frank Dölger. Frank Dölger is a producer of the HBO series Game of Thrones, Rome, and John Adams. He has already won the highest US television award, the Emmy Award, for 6 times. He is responsible for development and production at Intaglio Films, a joint venture between ZDF Studios and Beta Film. And the company produced the series The Swarm and is planning further projects. Frank, welcome to the show.
It's very nice to be here, and thank you very much. I'm honored to join your illustrious roster of guests.
Oh, thank you very much. Good to have you here. So could you explain your work to our listeners and take them a little bit into your world for a moment? So what do you do as a showrunner, as an executive producer? What exactly was your job on a series like Game of Thrones?
Well, being a showrunner and executive producer varies from project to project. On a lot of projects, it is a combination of writing and producing. On some projects, it's really more producing. The origin of the showrunner job really came from series television, in which you had multiple directors. On a feature film, you have a director, and that director is pretty much responsible for creating the world, delivering the performances, every aspect of the project, and the producer pretty much serves the creative vision of the director. On a series, when you have 4 or 5 directors per season, as we did on Game of Thrones and we had on The Swarm, it really falls to the executive producer showrunner to actually deliver on the promise of the vision of the show, the casting, all the locations, all the key creative decisions have to be made by someone. And clearly you can't split that decision between 4 or 5 directors. So that's a little bit how I function as an, I really very much work alongside directors and writers, but it's my responsibility to make sure that all the participants in the project, all the creative voices, come together in a unified whole.
So I plan to ask you, what does a typical workday look like when you're working on a product, but there is no typical workday, or?
No. You know, I've always sort of compared my job to either a conductor in an orchestra or to a coach on a sports team. In the sense that the most important part for me is the rehearsals. What I need to do is to make sure all the members of the team are on the same page. So if you think about an orchestra, everybody has in front of them a score. But if you have a room full of musicians, how do they interpret that score? If you're playing sports and you have a lot of members of a team, they all know the game, but how do you get them playing the same game? So my work is essentially every day making sure there's a unified vision, that I'm there to answer the questions and direct, conduct, coach the team towards the end. And ironically, if I've done my job well, certainly when we get to shooting, there's not much for me to do. I'm always interested when I watch very good sports teams, how little the coaches actually do. You see them walking on the sidelines, you see them watching, but they very rarely interfere or offer things. And so again, I think I'm there as to provide a creative vision, try to make sure that everybody is comfortable with that. And unless there's a problem, it's a pretty straightforward job.
So from your year-long experience, what would you say, what are the most important factors for a successful series?
I think that it's the key elements for most films and most projects. You start with the screenplay or script. Casting is obviously essential. Making sure the translation from the page to the screen realizes the vision of that. You always have a budget issue, so you always have to try to make sure to see if you can spend the money where it needs to be spent. And I think I'm a little bit unusual in that I believe that it's a very flexible process. I know a lot of producers who lock scripts 3 months before they shoot, that once they start shooting, the script doesn't change at all. And in post-production, it's a very straightforward job. I've just found through my experience that I don't want to ever stop the creative process. So for me, a lot of the most important script work is done once we've started casting. Once we actually are on locations, we see how the actors interact with each other. We see how the lines are playing. I think also once I get into post-production, it's amazing how many ways you can arrange the scenes you shot, particularly in a series. And then, of course, you have all the key elements of sound and music and effects. So I try to keep the process very fluid and let it develop and change rather than having a locked vision when we begin.
I sometimes have the feeling that in Germany we still have some catching up to do in the area of storytelling. How do we structure this series from a dramaturgical standpoint for an entire season? How do we use cliffhangers? How do we make sure that the series becomes a page-turner like a book that you have to keep watching it? So how do you see that? Do you see any differences between countries internationally in the area of storytelling and storytelling in series over a lot of episodes?
I think I probably would have answered that question differently 5 or 6 years ago. Again, I did not have that much exposure to European television. And then when I did start watching it, I think I came in a period where people were being more ambitious and a bit more risky. I think that probably the main difference, certainly in my projects, now again, I have to preface this, but I've had the luxury of working almost all my career for HBO, and HBO made their mark by doing things differently.
So
what I learned from that experience is that not to be afraid of complexity, not to be afraid of ambiguity, to give the audience a chance to figure it out for themselves. On Game of Thrones, we introduced lots of plot lines that didn't play out for 2 or 3 or 4 seasons. Even with individual seasons, we would introduce characters or plot lines. People were mystified. Sometimes they're confused. Hopefully they're intrigued and they stay with it. So I think that's one of the things that I believe that broadcasters on this side of the Atlantic are moving towards, the understanding that you can have a bit more complexity, less clear through lines, and trust the audience to put the pieces together.
Yes, when we're talking about the beginning of Game of Thrones and the beginning of this project, so I really thought about that point that you mentioned. So do you have a specific technique to keep an overview of the multitude of storylines in that production? So because it's so huge and there are so many parts of that story, and I think in the beginning it must have been really hard to make a comprehensive product out of that.
It was very difficult, but again, the tools you use are the same tools any producer will use on a film or a series, which is simply that you try to have a very thorough understanding of the plot. You know, what are the actual beats of the story from the beginning to the end? What is the intersection of those storylines with the characters? And those pieces move all the time, but I think most of the time you want to start the project with an overall sense of where you're going. Also, I know from my own experience that as you start, sometimes you end up in a rather different place. I know on The Swarm, we ended up in the course of the production probably writing 40 new scenes that were never envisioned. There were moments that things that happened on the set between the characters, with the plot lines, where things came into clarity, things seemed to present opportunities. So it, again, it's a very ongoing process. You try to start with the best blueprint possible. I think for people who have ever built a house, for me, it's a little bit like you start with the blueprints, but in terms of how do you furnish it, what are the paint colors, where are the changes you make? Once you actually walk through the structure, you realize that what you might have envisioned on the page wasn't quite the same. Some rooms seem too big, some rooms are too small, you realize you don't have enough closets. So I think for me, it's very much the same. You start with the process and the understanding and the blueprint. And you just keep taking a look every step along the way.
So I read the story that there was some confusion in the beginning of the project. And then I read that you sat down at night in the cutting room. And so you were doing a 20-minute version where this project had to. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
It was an incredibly ambitious project. And it was a departure for HBO. And there was a very protracted and involved conversation about how did we get the balance between fantasy and reality correct? What was the proper balance? And my instinct, not being a fan of this genre, not having read the novels and my other work, I felt we had to be squarely in the world of reality with the add-on of the fantasy. I think people who are fans of the genre felt the opposite. They felt what the audience wanted and they needed to deliver because it was Game of Thrones, was more of the fantastic elements. So we went down that route for very good reasons and we shot a pilot. And the pilot had wonderful moments, but also I think that the reality of the show and the character development was underserved. So there was a period of conversation when, after the first episode was put together, as scripted, the writers, the showrunners, the creators, we all realized that it wasn't quite working. So what I was asked to do, with everybody's blessing, was to come in and look at the 70 minutes and see within that 70 minutes if we could put together 20, 25 minutes, which was representative of what the show should be. So I worked with the editors, I worked with the writers, the creators, and we came up with a 20-minute version of the pilot. And that was a pilot that 20-minute version was very much character-based. It really showed the rich potential of the storylines and the characters as they had been envisioned by the creators of the show and the author of the novel. And fortunately, there were some very brave executives who, on the basis of that 20 minutes, gave us the green light.
So do you?
And actually, it turned out to be an incredibly valuable experience because it actually gave us, again, the path forward. We then knew that for the show to work, and this is something that I think a lot of people responded to, that it had to be, even though it was in this fantasy world, it had to be as real and grounded as possible. And the overlay of fantasy was something that was there and we could grow and encourage from season to season. But I think the first season was really essential to ground it in the real world.
So you mentioned that. So do you think it was an advantage that you weren't a fan of this genre?
Yes, very much so, because I remember that there was a conversation. I was not part of this conversation, but I heard about this conversation that the author of this novel was very concerned about his fan base. He had an enormous number of readers who loved the books, and there was a conversation about we had to make sure that we didn't alienate the fans. And I believe, and I wasn't there, but what I was told, HBO informed George R.R. Martin that if everybody who ever read any of his books tuned in to the first season, the show wouldn't last past one episode. That audience was just too tiny. Yeah. For the show to succeed, we had to get everybody who didn't read those books, who wasn't a fan of that genre. So for me, I was the perfect audience. I also decided not to read the books because when I was in some very early meetings with the writers, I would ask questions. And quite often the answer would come back, well, in the books. And I realized that there had to be someone in the room who hadn't read the book, so would be asking the kinds of questions I would be asking and the audience would probably be asking.
So that's what I sometimes think when I see a mediocre film which was made by a book. So you sit down there in the cinema and you only think, okay, it's just like the book, only shorter, and there are some important parts missing. So I really the notion of thinking about how can we create something with the central content from that and create a new thing for a broader audience is really an interesting point. So
It's the most difficult part of adaptation because, of course, you're dealing with a very successful work of art, a novel or a series of novels.
Yeah.
And they succeed because of all the elements the authors bring to them. The elements you're going to bring to the adaptation are completely different. So I think I've been mixed about this. I have seen adaptations which I think are wonderful. I've seen adaptations where I leave the theater thinking the film, the novel was so much better.
Yeah.
So I think, again, for some people, it's a very, very difficult process. Some people enjoy the changes. Some people feel that it hasn't delivered in the same way that the underlying work has.
So let's talk about The Swarm. So did you read the novel before you joined the project, or was it also a process like Game of Thrones?
No, I read the novel and I read it twice because I had heard of the novel. I knew it had been a phenomenon success. And so I was really curious about what it was about the book that had inspired so many fans and had contributed to success. So I did read it. I actually read it twice, once to just enjoy the pleasure of it, and the second time to analyze it in terms of its potential for adaptation.
So we know now what you changed in the adaptation, but what were your first thinkings about what do I have to change to make a successful series out of that book?
I think the first question I asked myself was, What was a genre that the series would be? I think when I read the novel, I felt that there were a lot of different genres. It's partly disaster movie. It's partly a scientific investigation. It's partly an adventure story. And upon reading it, clearly also for budgetary reasons, I was thinking, this is a story in which there's something out there that's very scary. And the question is, what is it? How is it behaving? Is it friendly? Is it a foe? And I thought, actually, what I thought was we wanted to make a monster movie. We wanted to make a monster movie with a lot of people know there's something out there. They can't see it. They just know it's there. And a lot of good monster movies, you can't see the monster. But also what I realized at the end is that you had to realize that actually the monster was us. Because what I really felt very strongly that the audience needed to understand that the year was acting in self-defense. And I remember I was asked this question really, really early on from someone who had read the book. Given the thousands of people, the tens, hundreds of thousands of people that die in the novel, how would the audience feel sympathy for the year? And I thought of a very simple distinction, which is, if someone walks into a store with a gun and shoots five people, takes the money from the cash register and runs out the door, that's one crime. If I woke up at night and there was an intruder in my house, and to save my wife and my children, I had to kill that person, that's a very different story. That's an act of self-defense. So what I wanted to do was two things, one of which makes sure the audience understood that the year was acting in self-defense to protect itself, the creatures it had spawned, and the world in which it lived. And also, I wanted to de-escalate the violence. I didn't want to have the hundreds of thousands of people die that died in the novel. I wanted to focus on a handful of characters and keep the carnage as limited as possible so that you didn't have that enormous imbalance. So again, that to me was key to understanding that the year does not want to do this. The year is being made to do this by what we have done to it.
So what would you say, how big are the differences in working in the German market compared to the US market, not to mention the budgets?
In terms of the filmmakers I work with, I think that the difference was for them, a lot of them were not used to working with multiple directors. And I think for them, production designers, costume designers, casting directors to know that there are going to be four or five directors, but those directors, you welcome their input, you want their input on individual episodes, but ultimately they have to make decisions based on their vision of the show. It has to be our collective vision, and the directors have to get on board with us. And that's a very different mentality if you've worked on films. And I think they were all, quite honestly, they were very anxious about it. And they were overly, I think it took a while for them to find their place. But once they understood that what I was saying to them, this is the world that you are creating, that we are creating together. You have to take ownership of that. And I certainly found, particularly in production and post-production, it was really remarkable how much they relished the creative freedom of feeling they actually were the creators of this vision alongside of us, rather than simply answering to a director's vision.
Yeah, perfect. So as you talked about post-production, I think the next project, Concordia, is right now in post-production. Could you tell us a little bit about this second project of you here in Germany?
The project we just shot in, we're in post-production right now, is called Concordia. And this is a project that I've been thinking about different aspects for a year. And it was really inspired by my reading about utopian communities. I think the first mention of utopia community is in Plato, as I understand, in the Republic. And through the years, there have been lots of attempts. I think in the 19th and 20th century, the ones we're most familiar with are what Siemens did in Germany, Michelin in France, England, you had Bourneville, Cadbury, the US, you had Hershey, Pennsylvania, and there are quite a few in Asia as well. So we were thinking about what the 21st century version be. And clearly, if you're going to create a utopian community now, a society which you would be creating to essentially create a safe, healthy environment for people who, for the working community. And we started doing some research into all the social engineering people would want to approach. So how do you lessen the divide between the haves and the have-nots? How do you deal with the inequality of healthcare? How do you make sure that you can welcome, instead of closing your borders for people from the other world, how can you actually open the borders and make sure they're integrated? And we decided to, and of course, how do you create a sustainable community? So the story really is about a group of entrepreneurs, visionaries, who in the wake of a terrible massacre in a small town, decided to, like the phoenix raising from the ashes, see if they could create a new community on the ruins of the old, where they could do an experimental community. The key to this community was that they felt that they wanted to make sure they could use a very sophisticated AI system for the safety of the people. Clearly, there are advantages for monitoring of health, but actually what the most appealing thing was about it, they actually felt that you could actually create a system where everybody is on camera all the time, but no one would ever see that footage unless something monitored it, something triggered an alert. Unless something came to someone's attention, you would have complete privacy. They'd install firewalls so no one could track your online behavior. No one could tap into your phones. So ironically, it's a world where surveillance is incredibly sophisticated. It's very much a part of everyday life, but you have much more privacy. That's the origin of Concordia. We pick up the story 20 years later. It's been an enormous success by every standard. They have decided there's cities and countries around the world lining up to be the next Concordia, the next experimental community. They decide that the next community will be in the former East Germany, because if you can convince people who grew up in the former East that surveillance could be a good thing, you would send a message to the entire world. So that's how we watch the drama unfold. And what, of course, you discover is that no matter how good a system is, no matter how good the intentions of the people who create this system, evil always comes from within. So part of it's a thriller, part of it's trying to discover actually what is threatening the community. But again, what was interesting in my experience, without exception, when I would describe this project to people, particularly directors, they all came in thinking it was going to be a dark dystopian drama. And they got to the end of the six episodes and they were stunned that actually there was no surprise. The AI was incredibly good. The surprises were completely what they weren't expected. So that's Concordia.
Yeah, when I heard that and when I read that, I really thought a very good timing, because we have a lot of discussion about AI at the moment. So you already heard of ChatGPT, generative AI, the use of AI for the creative processes. So do you think that AI developed series will perhaps sometimes have a permanent place in the streaming services portfolio, or will be the human origin still be the standard in 5 years?
I think the standard will. I mean, I think from the beginnings of theater to where we are right now, the standard are dramas that explore human dilemmas and human characters. And I think that no matter how good animation is, no matter how good AI is, it will never be the same. There's something messy, there's something uncomfortable, there's something haphazard about our lives that I think you capture on film that you can't capture when you animate shows, you can't capture no matter how sophisticated the AI. So I think there will be very successful projects. It will be, it will have its fan. I would like to believe, and I do believe, that the core of the entertainment we all enjoy, either for educational purposes, for emotional purposes, simply for the sheer enjoyment of it, will be character-based and with actors at the heart of it.
So streaming services like Netflix are strongly associated with data collection, and it's said that it's much easier to analyze which content works and which doesn't than in linear television, for example. But what do you think, and with your experience, so is that really true? So what role do data and the analysis of data play in your creative and strategic work if you develop new products?
Very simply, what I do is I listen to the people who hire me. So when I first had my conversations with ZADF, and they said they really want this project to attract a younger audience. They have a very solid older audience, but they would hope we could find it with a project they would attract a younger audience. So I'm assuming that that request is based on research they've done. But all I knew was that was one of the ambitions of the piece. So I don't follow the data. I don't actually follow who's watching what. I'm always curious about films that win awards. I'm always curious about films that catch the popular imagination. No one was more surprised that Game of Thrones became the most successful television series of all time than we were. How that happened, I don't know. But my brief is very much is to try to satisfy the demands of any piece of material and pay allegiance to what the people who are hiring me in financing a project are hoping to achieve.
Yeah, so some people say data is always from the past, and you really can't predict the future with data from the past. But how much have these streaming services, and you have a really long experience from the television industry to now, you really have the full perspective of that in the business. So what would you say, how have these services like Netflix, Amazon, Prime Video, Apple, HBO Max, Disney Plus, how have they changed the market and the work in this market?
That's a tough question to answer. I will say two things. Over the course of my career, I remember four or five different waves where I would go into a meeting and people would say, period's not working now. And then I remember period was working. Mm-hmm. Then I was remember that comedies weren't working. They were working. Serious subject matters weren't working. Serious matters were. I mean, so there seemed to be different interpretations. A show comes along and suddenly everybody's looking for that. So I do think it's always the dog chasing its tail a little bit. Mm-hmm. So I think that is something that I've seen repeat. I think that the big difference for me is how much more comfortable people are with projects that seem to have nothing to do with their lives. Projects coming out of Asia, projects coming out of other countries without much of a tradition. I think particularly when the foreign films don't seem to be attracting an audience, the fact that there's so many shows. So people are comfortable reading subtitles. People are intrigued by a completely inexperienced exposure to a completely different culture. I think that's something that is very, very, very recent. I mean, really very much a result of the streaming services and their international catalogs. So I think, and it was interesting, I had my own version of this. I remember when we started The Swarm, and again, it was going to be an international project. But my definition, I realized it in retrospect, was pretty much American and Northern European. And we, much to our surprise, we got approached by Hulu Japan, who had read the material and liked it, and wanted to know if we thought there was a way to include a Japanese storyline. And as it turned out, there was a storyline that was not very convincing. It was something that was a holdover from the novel about a Chinese-American character, and it really... And I suddenly realized when I was doing a bit of research, there's probably... I can't think of any nation that's more dependent on the sea than Japan. When you think about, it's an island nation, you think about the, and I thought, well, if anybody's going to be concerned about what's going on in the oceans, it'd be the Japanese. And that really completely transformed my thinking about the definition of international. And I believe that storyline completely transformed the project. And so I think that was very much, not only because of that suggestion, but also because I think I had been watching a lot of many more shows coming out of Asia and other countries. So I think a lot of people's taste has been widened by what the streamers have done in terms of exposing us to projects coming from all over the world. I also think that it's forced people to be more adventuresome. I mean, shows that seem that you can't define in terms of the genre, shows that are clearly a bit more experimental. I think people are more comfortable and are a little bit less afraid of those now.
That's interesting. So I sometimes think that that all these new television platforms, formats, they have their life cycle. So when you remember when YouTube started, so it was all about user-generated content. So everybody was thinking, okay, it's a democratization of content, and everybody is doing these videos. And some years ago, you see big production companies who are doing cooking videos in a typical TV style, for example. So, and if you remember the beginning of Netflix, so I think their first series was Lilyhammer, which is really more an art house style than a mainstream thing. And if you see how it develops to a really mainstream thing, so that's really interesting for me. So are these platforms also changing from a more feature film style and niche audience in the beginning, like HBO really also was in the past, and are they going more and more mainstream, and do we will have a wider variety of streaming services, for example, and you have for some audience this kind of streaming service and for a mainstream audience this kind of streaming services. So will streaming go the same way as TV did in the last 30 years in terms of differentiation?
Well, again, this is my own perspective, but yes. I can tell you that one of the things that really concerns me is the idea of the streaming services being advertisers supported. Mm-hmm. And that's very simply this. Very early on in my career, I started off as a script reader, development executive at Columbia Pictures. And then I was hired by ABC Television to work on their movie and miniseries division. And it was really when the American networks were incredibly strong. And I think the month I started, there were three or four other young executives who were started. And we were invited to lunch with the chairman of ABC. And we all ascended to the heavens, you know, the executive dining room on the floor. We left our cubicle-style offices, you know, wearing our best suits and ties. And we were shown into the dining room, and the head of ABC came in, and he stood at the head of the table, and he said, "I want you all to remember one thing. you are filling the time between the commercials. And he left. He left the room. And so we all each looked, we looked at each other stunned, because most of us came from universities. Quite a few of us had studied literature. We had great aspirations for ourselves, and be told that our job was filling the time between the commercials. And of course, that was the business. You wanted to make sure you got a big audience, because you got a big audience, you had. So I think that led to the neutering of the originality of a lot of the networks. And I can't imagine that if you're going to be selling ads on Netflix, all these others, how is that going to affect the type of programming they're going to do? How are you going to sell ads if no one's watching things? So I'll be curious how that plays out. I think also there's just too much out there right now. I mean, I don't know anybody who has a stomach just to the idea of having all these. And I always compare it to every time I go to inexpensive Chinese restaurants and you're presented a 30-page menu,
yes,
your heart sinks. And I feel sometimes when I look at what's, and I, you know, I'd much rather go to a restaurant with maybe, you know, a 2-page menu. So I think it'll be interesting to see which are the services that people think offer the kind of things that cater to their taste and don't overwhelm them. So again, I've never been in this part of the business. I've always been simply producing things and what happens to them. So that's my take on as a little bit from my own experience, but also as an audience member.
And if we look at it from the producing side, so I sometimes have the feeling more and more content is needed. Is creativity and are creative people in video an inexhaustible potential? Or does more content also mean lower quality overall, if you look at content on average?
I can't help but think, well, there are two answers to that. And it really depends on which part of the business you're talking about. So one of the great things about the sheer abundance of projects being produced now is the number of actors, very, very good actors, who were never cast because there wasn't enough work. When you have fewer projects, and I know this from my own experience, and you're talking to broadcasters, you get the same list of actors. You know, it's a very small list of people who have names who you're always trying to attract. Well, there simply aren't enough of those actors to go around, which means that opportunities are opening for actors across the board. It's certainly happening for writers and directors as well. So in some ways, it's fantastic, particularly I think for some younger writers and directors coming along who are getting chances they don't have. The question is, will they prove to be true talents, or will they be people who were given experience and succeeded to a certain extent, but really haven't developed into the kind of talents whose work we're all going to follow? So it's great that so many doors are opening, and that, you know, but you know, I know my own experience when you put together crews, you're taking a lot of chances on people who haven't had the experience. And sometimes they haven't had the experience because they're not very good, but they happen to be the best people available. So there can't help but be a diluting of standards and quality. At the same time, you're hoping there'll be the talent pool is being refreshed now because there are so many more opportunities for people to learn their craft on projects.
So we're coming out of a pandemic right now. So, and I'd like to ask you, how intensely have the challenges of the COVID-19 pandemic affected you and your work?
I think I actually benefited from it by two reasons. One of which is the pandemic came along for our company at a stage of development when all the projects needed time. And I think that if it hadn't been for the pandemic, we may have started a little bit too early. So I think that it was a great opportunity for people to calm down, take a step back, really focus on what we were doing instead of racing ahead. I think also what was quite extraordinary for me, the first project we did was a swarm. And it was fascinating watching the crew. I mean, sometimes crews are quite territorial. You know, each division sticks to itself, and that you don't see a lot of help. Everybody came out of the pandemic very happy to be working again, really realizing how fragile the situation was, and that a degree of help between the departments, the civility, the kindness, the protection shown to each member of the crew, keeping each other safe, was really remarkable. And it reminded me that there's something fantastic when people have a common goal. There's always a goal uniting people to do a good project. But when people's welfare is at stake, it really, and I'm hoping, and I've seen actually some of that has actually lasted. There's a hangover of that because I think people still feel their livelihoods could be threatened at any moment. So it's interesting. For a lot of people, it was an incredibly difficult situation. I would just say that I saw that there was a benefit. And also, I did think we did try to take advantage of it as best we could. And I think we'll hopefully all be prepared for what happens next if it does come our way again.
When I looked at the very rare information about your biography, I saw that your career path looked different at first. So you could have been a lawyer now.
Yes, I was on my way to law school. Actually, I was on my way to law school three times.
Really?
When I finished university in America, I really didn't know exactly what I wanted to do. And so that was a point where certainly I was being told by my friends and family that law was a fantastic career because it opened a lot of doors. And as I had no particular path, no particular skills, I applied and was accepted to law school. And then I was fortunate to get a scholarship to Oxford. And I went off and had a wonderful time there. I didn't really want to have an academic career, but I luckily fell in with some people who were very involved in the theater. And I enjoyed that work tremendously. I thought at the time it was a little bit of a hobby. I was thinking I would have this experience and that I would go back to the United States and I would probably pick up where I left off. And then I had partnered with some friends. We did some shows at the Edinburgh Festival. We've got a lot of success. I directed some, produced some, and then I was offered a job working for a company, production company in London, which was great until my student visa expired and I was not able to get a work visa and I was given 3 weeks to leave the country. I left London, came back to New York without a job, and I reapplied, was reaccepted to law school. And I was really just trying to figure out a way to keep myself out of trouble and pay the bills a bit. And I started doing some reading and some internship, and I ended up the week before I was going off to law school, I was a reader at Columbia Pictures, and I got offered a full-time job at Columbia Pictures. So I told my family and I told the law school that I was going to come to law school at this point. And I did that my career went very well. There was a period in the middle when I was actually quite exhausted. I actually had been promoted too quickly, too fast. I had too many projects. And I really was feeling that the job was less satisfying than I wanted. And I thought very briefly about maybe I should think about law again, but maybe I would do law, something to do with the arts. So I reapplied and accepted to law school again. And then by that time, I was ready to go off to law school. I had recovered from the bad experiences I had and had a much clearer idea of which was the way to go. So once again, and this is the last time, the law school to which I've been accepted said, this is the last time, don't come back again. So that was a trajectory.
So that really reminds me of the quote of the singer and musician Billy Joel, who said to his mother, I don't go to Columbia University, I go to Columbia Records. So that's
yes.
Parallel.
Very, very much so. Yes. But it's interesting. It's very funny when people ask me, how do you find your way into producing? And I just said, I can't give you any particular guidance because, I think luck has an enormous amount to do with it. Clearly, you're lucky if your doors open for you. But it seemed for me it was a lot of happenstance and just coincidences. And luckily, it did all work out. But it could have worked out very differently, I'm aware of as well.
And I also read that you were a regular guest at the legendary Studio 54 back then. So could you tell us how legendary it really was?
It was truly extraordinary. And what made it extraordinary was very simple, which is that the first time I went there, I was actually having dinner. I'd heard about Studio 54. I had never been there, but I was having dinner on 54th Street, very far on the west side. And I was walking home along 54th Street, and there were 300 people standing in front of Studio 54. And I was standing there looking at the crowd, and suddenly I realized the doorman was pointing at me. The doorman was pointing at me and waving to come forward. So it's a little bit like Moses crossing the Red Sea. Suddenly, the crowd parts. You go in, and then you're inside Studio 54. And it's like you've won a race, because somehow you have been chosen. So everybody who got in was in a fantastic mood. So, it was just one of these things, like, again, it was very arbitrary, but I think at the beginning, at least for me, it was just this idea that everybody was so happy. It obviously had a much darker side for a lot of people. And I think also it became, you know, less interesting. And the last time I went, and this is where I saw the dark side, my brother with five friends had come down from university. I think he was 18 or 19 at the time. It was my brother, his two friends, and their girlfriends. And they wanted to go to Studio 54, so I said I would take them. So we went, we showed up, and the doorman, who I knew very well at this point, he said to me, he signaled to me, how many? I said, six. And he said, which six? And I pointed to my brother and his friends, and he said, those three yes, those three no. And I thought that was the cruelest thing I had ever heard. And my brother said, what's going on? I said, it's a private party. But I realized at that moment, I didn't want to go again. So that's where I had a different feeling of what was the darker side of that experience. But it was a great place to hide for 6 months when you don't know what you want to do with yourself, because you sort of go at 12 o'clock, you go 12 o'clock at night, you leave at 6 o'clock in the morning, you sleep, and then you spend another day not worrying about your future. So
I have some more questions that I'm asking every guest here. And the first question is, which book has particularly inspired and influenced you?
The work of nonfiction that's inspired me are the biography of Lyndon Johnson written by Robert Caro. And Robert Caro is an extraordinary biographer because he understands that history is driven by characters. And every page of that book, there's a character at the center of it. And I think I really admire the way that he's looking at history, and his storytelling is so extraordinary that when I first read those books, when I started thinking about some historical dramas, again, I realized that the characters were much more important than the events. In terms of nonfiction, in terms of fiction, I remember falling completely in love of a book by William Faulkner, the American author, The Sound and the Fury. I felt that it was so beautifully realized in terms of the world he created. And I remember thinking there's something fantastic about the ability to create this full world with every detail, that you actually understand the people, their lives, where they live, what they wear, what they eat. And I've always thought about that when I think about films that I'm making, because again, it was just a whole world created on the page. And if you can get that on the page, a question is, again, you should be able to get it on the screen.
So if this podcast would reach all people in Germany or also in the US, but you could only get one message out, so what message would that be?
Can I tell a story before I give you the message?
Yes, definitely.
Good. At the same period where I was thinking of leaving the business, I went to India for 2 months. And while I was there, I had this fantastic guide. She was an older woman, quite extraordinary, because at that point, for a woman to be a guide and to go into these parts of India. And in the course of this, we spent a lot of time going to all the great temples. And I learned that in Hinduism, there are 3,800,000 incarnations of God. There's one God, but... And I said to her, the very last day I was there, do you have one central tenet that you've taken from Hinduism? Because I think a lot of religions, there is always a central tenet. And she said to me, yes, ego leads to sorrow. And for me, that's been, I think, informed just about certainly my career and as much of my personal life. From that moment on, whenever I'm in a difficult situation, whether it's creative or personal, I always ask myself, what proportion of this, what is dictating my response, how much has to do with ego? And it's usually somewhere between 70 and 90%. Mm-hmm. And so I've just found that if you can ask yourself that question and you can back away, you have a much happier result. So I would leave everybody with the thought that think about how ego leads to sorrow.
Oh, that's nearly perfect, because I think that also fits the next question, if you have a tool or technique that particularly helps you in stressful or difficult times. So does that fit, or do you have another technique for especially stressful times?
This has changed over the course of my career, because usually in the early career, stressful situations, I created them.
Yes.
I think later in my career, I create less, so I'm much better at managing them. That's one of the advantages of age, is that every mistake that you can make in this business, you've made it sometime. So what I try to do is never challenge, never confront, to try to start being as reasonable as possible. I think if you can just diffuse the tension, if you can try to things make not things, you just lower the temperature, it helps. So, and that usually means letting yourself be a punching bag. You sort of have to take all the abuse that people want to, sort of send your way. But ultimately, I just think the best thing to do is just try not to engage. Because I know that when I was causing the crisis, it was usually, again, for whatever the reasons were. And if someone could talk me down, I usually ended up more being reasonable. So I think that's in the producers that I admire. That's what we all do, especially when you're dealing with a lot of very creative people, again, with big egos. Yeah. You sort of step back and let them just, have their say, and then try to engage slowly and in a more appropriate moment.
Frank Delger, thank you very much for being here in this show. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me, and it was great fun.
Und hier noch ein Programmtipp. Mit Ernährung Krankheiten in den Griff bekommen oder sogar heilen. Das kann funktionieren. Und die NDR Ernährungsdocs wissen, wie das funktioniert. Wissenschaftsjournalistin Julia Demann spricht mit Dr. Silja Schäfer, Dr. Viola Andresen und Dr. Matthias Riedel über ihre spannendsten Fälle und erstaunlichsten Erfolge. Essen als Medizin lautet die Strategie, und die Themen reichen von antientzündlicher Ernährung bis Zuckerersatz. Die gemeinsame Mission bei diesem Podcast: eine Ernährung, die schmeckt, die beim Gesundwerden und Bleiben hilft und die man auch leicht umsetzen kann. Und deshalb gibt's am Ende jeder Folge ein Rezept für zu Hause. Die Ernährungsdocs hört ihr jetzt in der ARD Audiothek, der Audio-App der ARD unter ardaudiothek.de oder in den App-Stores eurer Smartphones. Die Idee ist ein Podcast des NDR, und wenn euch dieser Podcast gefällt, dann bewertet ihn auf der Plattform, auf der ihr ihn hört, und empfehlt die Idee weiter. Für Feedback erreicht ihr uns unter dieidee@ndr.de. Vielen Dank an Producer Dennis Terrei. Die Idee ist ein Podcast vom NDR. Wir interviewen ExpertInnen. Äußerungen unserer InterviewpartnerInnen geben deren eigene Auffassung wieder. Der NDR macht sich Äußerungen seiner GesprächspartnerInnen und Gesprächspartner in Interviews und Diskussionen nicht zu eigen. Bis bald.